And here we are in modernity, and we've thrown all of that creativity away. We've traded it for what we deem as intellectually proper or really great, which is analytics. We assign numbers to everything. Look at my spreadsheet. I know exactly what my ROI is on that product. Yeah, but do you really know the full story? No. And you make all these decisions as a company, as a leader, based on what sits in your Excel, which is at best a snapshot of something that happened in the rearview mirror. We need a different system. We need to reimagine and recreate that childhood wonder that we all had, because as kids, we were great. We were very, very creative. We traded that for analytics. And now we're wondering, like, hey, why can't I get to the next level? I want this promotion. Why can't my company grow in this segment? We've tried everything. And the analytics showed us time and time again that this will solve the problem. And yet we still have the problem. Why? We're not applying creative and innovative principles. We're only applying analytical principles. And that will never, ever solve problems.
Welcome. Can I ask you a controversial question? Those people who are making a massive difference in the world, are they inspiring you? Or if you're really honest, are they kind of a bit disheartening? Because sometimes you've been left with this sinking feeling of, oh, I could never do that. Well, what if the story that the world is broken is the most dangerous lie that leaders like us, we keep repeating it as well as telling ourselves? See, we're told every day that humanity is failing, that we're overwhelmed, outmatched, overpopulated, under-resourced, headed towards some catastrophic collapse. But what if that narrative isn't the truth, but it's a filter? Yes, just a filter. A filter that narrows our thinking, shrinks our courage, and convinces intelligent people to just stop trying. Well, my guest today is Nir Brashan. He is the author of The Solution Mindset, and he makes the bold claim, and by bold, I mean not inspirationally bold, I mean intellectually and confrontationally bold, that virtually every problem we're facing, personal, organizational, even global, are solvable. Not through positive affirmations or not through slogans, but through disciplined creativity fused with innovation. I talk more about Nir Brashan in just a moment. Welcome to the Dov Barron Show. Come for the stories, stay for the truth that gives birth to new meaning. I'm your host, Dov Barron. I work with the elite leaders and organizations who are quietly and positively shaping the trajectory of industries and entire nations. My work is in helping you diagnose and rewire your emotional source code so you can stop unconsciously leading from your oldest wounds in your nervous system. When you stop leading from your scars and lead from truth, meaning, and purpose, that truth alters everything from your vision, your values, your worthiness, and even your biology. And now back to Nir Brashan. According to Nir and his brilliant new book, The Solution Mindset, whether it's coral reefs or prisons, clean water or broken hiring systems, from failure to redemption, this conversation will happily challenge the assumptions that complexity is inevitable and that despair is realistic. The real question isn't whether solutions exist. The real question is this: have we even trained ourselves to stop seeing the solution? Today, we're going to talk about why leaders lose their problem-solving edge, and how fear masquerades as realism, why data without wisdom is dangerous, and why comparing yourself to anyone else might be the single fastest way to kill your creativity and your creative intelligence. If you're the kind of leader who wants depth over dopamine hits, hit that subscribe button right now. This is where serious thinkers come to sharpen their edge. You're about to question the beliefs that have been burning through your potential for years. And the answers, well, they're going to be a little uncomfortable sometimes, but if you take them on, you will absolutely love the results. If you're willing to question what you think you know, and you might just restore something more leaders didn't realize they'd already lost, which is the belief in their own capability to solve what actually matters. So ladies and gentlemen, turn up the volume and help me to welcome author of The Solution Mindset, Mastering the Art of Problem Solving, returning champion, Nir Brashan. Welcome, Nir.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dove. What a great intro. Man, that was cool.
Well, you deserve it, mate. You definitely deserve it. I'm glad to have you here. I was saying right at the beginning, it seems almost inevitable, this idea that we're all going to hell in a handbasket. In the introduction, I asked, what if the story that the world is broken is the most dangerous lie we keep repeating. Do you think that that's true? Do you think that we're just repeating it and so it becomes true to us?
Yeah, I think it's comfortable. So it's like a warm blanket that we've had as kids. We wrap ourselves up in these things that we hear because they give us comfort. And somehow we've convinced ourselves, yep, everything is horrible. And we believe it. Now, the media backs that up, Dove, every single day. You turn on, I don't know how you consume your news or your media and how your audience consumes it, but you turn it on and it's more than likely bad news. And so one, it's comfortable. Two, it's repeated everywhere. And three, we need to change it now.
So, you know, what's interesting is that when we look at all of that, it's comfortable. So what we know is that neurochemically, from a neuroscience point of view, the brain is conserving energy. And it's actually easier to believe what we already believe that rather than think of something new. And so brilliant new ideas can often seem like too much work. So it's very easy to go to these black-white solutions. One of the things that I really liked and loved about your book and digging in was that is edgy, but in a way that is possible, it invites creativity back. And I've had this conversation with many people. It feels like it's almost like we box creativity away. It's something that we're only allowed when things are blossoming and, oh, it's time to be creative now. And for me, the most innovative time is when things are shit. When things are really down the toilet, that's when we get most creative. We're actually most creatively lazy when things are good. And your book invites us back to the creative. So talk to us about why you believe that creativity is the last competitive advantage.
So I agree with you. I think it does come out when we need it the most. We hide it away and we keep it under lock and key. I agree with you 100%. This is the problem, is that just as you said, we feel that we can only use creativity when times are good.
Mm-hmm.
We pat ourselves on the back. Hey, we've gotten that RFP. We've made that account happen. We've gotten to that next stage in our careers. We're good to go. Everything is fine. Now we could be creative. I argue that if we really want to be creative and really want creativity to work for us, we need to look at the bad times. We need to look at the hard times. We need to look at the times where so very few people actually recall that creativity, actually go out there and re-harness it. That's a big, big problem, Dove. It's a big, big problem. I see it every single day in almost every industry that I work with. Just about everyone doesn't feel confident in their ability to solve problems on a regular basis. And that problem solving comes from creative and innovative thinking.
But you just said the word, right? You said the word feel. And we think of creativity as something inspirational. We're inspired to create. Therefore, we've got to be feeling good. I know it's bullshit, but it's the bullshit we tell ourselves. How do you get somebody into this mindset of, I know you don't feel creative right now, but creativity is the very thing you need. And so it feels like it's a loop for people. They feel like, I need to be creative, but I'm not inspired to be creative, so I can't be creative. And there's nothing really very inspiring, so I'm not creative. And it's this horrible loop. How do we get out of that?
We need to start to practice creativity like we practice just about anything else. And it's something that we need to say to ourselves. We need to believe. We need to jump in. Far too many people think that creativity is something that happens to them once a week, or they take a shower, or only when I'm walking on Tuesdays after 4 o'clock do I ever get an idea and I need to have the dog walk, the kids taken care of, and all of this stuff. All of that is complete BS. What we need to do, we need to make time every single day to practice the tenets of creativity so that when we need them the most, they're right there. We just need to go grab them.
All right. So I get what you're saying. It's a discipline. The other thing is how we frame creativity. We say, oh, well, the artists and the singers and the movie makers, they're creative. I'm some schmuck who can't even draw a matchstick. How can I possibly be creative? So walk us through that sort of hurdle.
So we get that all the time, right? People say creativity is just art or music or drawing. There's nothing that could be further from the truth. Creativity, in the way that we're taught it and we think about it, is a very small sliver of the entire spectrum. Creativity, to me, is the one innate human ability that we have that we're all born with. It's in our DNA to be able to solve problems only as a human can. That is the type of creativity that I help leaders and I help companies recover.
So you're saying from your point of view that creativity and problem solving are intimately linked. Is that right?
1,000%. The reason we are creative is to solve innate problems that happened to us back in the day, 30, 40, 50, 60,000 years ago. Early man needed creativity to survive. The only reason we are here now, Dove, and that the world is not a bunch of dinos is because we were the most creative species on Earth. We could communicate with language. Don't eat that berry. You're going to die. Don't do this. So on and so forth. And here we are in modernity, and we've thrown all of that creativity away. We've traded it for what we deem as intellectually proper or really great, which is analytics. We assign numbers to everything. Look at my spreadsheet. I know exactly what my ROI is on that product. Yeah, but do you really know the full story? No. And you make all these decisions as a company, as a leader, based on what sits in your Excel, which is at best a snapshot of something that happened in the rearview mirror. We need a different system. We need to reimagine and recreate that childhood wonder that we all had, because as kids, we were great. We were very, very creative. We traded that for analytics. And now we're wondering like, hey, why can't I get to the next level? I want this promotion. Why can't my company grow in this segment? We've tried everything. And the analytics showed us time and time again that this will solve the problem. And yet we still have the problem. Why? We're not applying creative and innovative principles. We're only applying analytical principles. And that will never, ever solve problem.
Let's just sort of get down to the nitty gritty of it, the meat of it right now. How can someone listening to us or watching us, whether they're in a very high level leadership role, who often feel like I can't be creative, I don't have time to be creative, I'm too busy making, quote, hard decisions, black, white, right, wrong, yes, no decisions. So they feel like, well, there's no room for my creativity. Or the person who is lower than them, who feels like, well, I can't be creative because I always need the nod from somebody above. Where can they start? Is there a pathway that opens up that gives them space to say, all right, here's how I apply creativity to a problem?
100%. So everyone's pathway is different. My new book, The Solution Mindset, has a lot in there to help people become more creative. But something that somebody could try right now, hey, I'm a leader, you know, I need to become more creative. Hey, I'm a mid-manager level, trying to get up there. My boss won't let me do something creative. What do I do near? Okay, the first thing that people can do anywhere is to create what I call a silly idea meeting. A silly idea meeting. Now, Dove, you probably know this because we've been friends a long time, but I used to work in the music business a long time ago. As glamorous as that sounds, I would pick up cigarette butts with Aerosmith, right? They would come to town and I'd be like, look, I'm working for Aerosmith. And my parents would be like, wow, what are you doing? Are you doing the sound? Are you up there on stage? Are you playing guitar? No, I'm picking up cigarette butts in the parking lot. It has to get done. And I noticed that they would have a meeting every Monday. Every Monday they would have a meeting. They called it the stupid idea meeting, but we'll call it the silly idea meeting because language is very important. They got together and somebody would say, hey, let's have a silly idea meeting where we talk about a new song. Okay, cool. Topic is new song. Go. And somebody would say, hey, I got an idea about a microphone. Okay, what's the song? Microphones are great. They sound really wonderful. That's the song. And everybody would be like, oh, that's a stupid idea. Oh, that's terrible. And then somebody would say, oh, I got a really good idea for a song, okay? It's Love in an Elevator, Living It Up While We're Going Down. And oh, brilliant, right? What a great song. And then they would write it and it would be one of their best hits. Something your listeners can do right now is go to their Outlook, put a 15-minute meeting for Monday. I don't know when you're listening to this, but do it for the next Monday. Do it in the morning, 9, 10, 11 a.m. Okay, put 15 minutes in there and put silly idea meeting. Invite your team, your manager. My boss won't allow me to do it. Great, your manager, invite your team. The owner of the company, your C-suite leader, even better, invite 3 or 4 people on your leadership team. Okay, tell them for 15 minutes, we will be going around. Everyone gets 1 minute. come up with a really silly idea. You know what's going to happen, Dove? People are going to laugh. It's going to be kind of funny. They're going to go through some back and forth. By the second or third week that you do this, you are going to generate at least one idea that will change your company forever. All because you took a little bit of gumption, a little bit of time out to allow the working on creativity. In a month or two, you're going to have people just foaming at the mouth. Can't wait for that meeting. Best meeting of the week. Why? Because we get to share ideas that are 3 years down the road, 5 years down the road. Oh, nobody would ever go for this, but what if they would type of ideas? And all that happened is because you scheduled 15 minutes to talk with your team about something different.
I think that's awesome. I used to have this program that I ran for corporations. And as soon as we hit a wall, people just get so stuck in their bloody ways and they're like trying to come up with stuff. And it's like, oh my God, it's like drier than you could possibly. And I'd say, is everybody familiar with Monty Python? Usually people were, because the people I'm dealing with are not 20 or generally. So they know who Monty Python is. I go, okay, it's time for a Monty Python moment. And I say, we have to talk about this problem as if it's a Monty Python sketch. And if the same idea, but what it was permission to be silly. And I think that a lot of the times where we get stuck and block out our own creativity, and obviously if you've got a different opinion, I'm totally open to that. But if we get so rigid in things that we can't see anything in front of us, so it was like this permission to be silly, this permission to be off color, this permission to be non-politically correct, because certainly Monty Python was not that, but just to make it about something else. That suddenly when it just opens up those creative juices that start to flow and it starts to be so delicious. And you go, oh, well, hold on a second. That's kind of crazy. But what if that part, is that what you're saying?
100%. It allowed somebody else in the room also, Dove, to go, wow, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I mean, it is dumber than like giving stuff away for free. And then somebody else goes, giving stuff away for free, that's a really good idea. Yeah, we're a software as a services company, but instead of giving the first, 14 days away like everyone else is, let's give 90 days away for free. And then somebody else goes, that's the dumbest idea. Why would we ever give away 90 days for free when we can charge people to start and then give away the 90 days? Then somebody else says, we'll give the 90 days at the end. And then somebody else says, oh my gosh, what a good idea. And all of a sudden you're leading your team into some productive and innovative thinking. Again, everybody needs time to be creative. It's not something that's going to strike you at 2 a.m. on the third Thursday of every month when there is only a full moon. It's something we need to act on. That is one thing that your listeners can start right now, regardless of the level. Even if they're an entry-level person, they can get their people together that are in their entry level as well and say, guys, let's come up with an idea to solve some specific problem.
So the framework here is that creativity fixes problems. The path to solutions is creativity. But the key is in understanding that to be creative, you have to give yourself permission. And the permission is not, yes, you're free to be creative, but you have to give it a framework of permission. And the framework of permission is often in silliness, permission to not be conventional, to think out, I hate the term think outside the box, but to think in a way that is non-conventional about the thing. And so again, in our corporate work, when we do the Monty Python, we'd have to say, okay, so if Monty Python was discussing this in the context of quantum physics, and we're talking about sales, and so how would they do it? And they're like, well, that's stupid. That's the point. You can't. So let's just do it. And then they go, oh, okay. So it'd be the Institute of Funny Quarks. Yes. Okay, good. So you worked in the music industry. Did you always see yourself as a creative problem solver?
Yes. I've always seen myself as somebody who can use creativity in ways that others can't. And I was like, man, this is great. And then as I started to kind of rise up the ladder running advertising agencies, which I did forever, I would ask other leaders, hey, that was a really creative idea. The way you position the pricing model, for instance, that's brilliant. How did you come up with that? Oh, man. Well, we don't want to talk about it. That's my thing. That's my intellectual property or whatever. And I was like, wait a second. This is a nut that we can all crack. Why? Because it's good for humanity. We can solve all kinds of problems if we're willing to talk about sharing about creativity and how we got there. It's good for humanity. No. That's my IP. I'm not sharing it. And so that's what led to this book. I feel a burning desire, perhaps selfishly, to energize people to solve problems that are bothering me, right? Like pollution and all kinds of problems that we're having across the world. I want people to work on those solutions selfishly so that I can live in a better world, that my children can have a better world.
So let's talk about that for a minute. Let's talk about the framework of the book, because you went to specific people who were solving specific problems that the rest of us might not think of as being particularly creative people. And certainly the problems seem way too big for some doodling if we're thinking of creativity as an art piece. Talk to us about why you went after what you went after in order to frame the book.
So Dove, I literally went to ChatGPT and I asked it to make a list of the worst problems on earth. And it did. Pollution, healthcare, hiring and discrimination. It made me a list of the top. And then I literally took that list and I said, aha, I have a list of the worst problems on earth that only one technique that I know of can possibly solve. And that technique is applying creativity and innovation. Most people think of creativity as being, you know, a musician or an artist or something. I see creative people as people who attack tenaciously and solve problems in different ways than the standard protocol is, because they have to in order to have the problem be commensurate with the solution. If we are using tools that are antiquated and not up to date and not up to the challenge, we're not going to be able to solve the problems that we have in front of us. ChatGPT made me a list of the worst things on earth, and I literally went out. Some of them are my friends, Dove, that I've known for years. Some of them are perfect strangers that I've met over the course of building this book. But I took what they are doing and saw the amazing creative value that they're giving. And then I broke down, hey, I'm an accountant. What do I have to do with the pollution people? Well, this is what you can use. Hey, I'm in manufacturing. What can I use? This is what you can use. So everybody has a blueprint of what they can do to become more creative, much like that 15-minute silly idea meeting. Doesn't matter what field you're in. These are tools that you can use to apply to solve problems in your own life.
So as we come to the end of part one of the show, give me one of the examples of one of the sort of global problems and then what you learn from somebody who is solution focused in that global problem that somebody could use who's in the accounting business or whatever it might be. Because it seems so separate.
Abstract.
Yeah, exactly.
For real. So I'll start with my friend Tito on Benicott, who is 16 years old, surfing every day, goes to his favorite surf spot, finds no surf, right? So him and his friends are divers. Most surfers are great swimmers, divers, the whole deal. They look, the reef's not looking good. It's just not looking good. He goes home, Googles it, comes up with some ideas. Hey, maybe I should cut the reef. Maybe I should put a cable down there and plant coral, or maybe I should come up with all these ideas. He goes and he talks to the scientists. There's scientists in quite a big marine biology department and outreach in the Tahitian island. So he goes there and he goes, guys, I got a great idea. Let's do this, that, and the other thing. And they're like, dude, you're 16. One, you need a degree. Two, you're a kid. Three, you don't know what you're talking about. Four, you're a kid. Five, all of the rest of them combined, plus you need another 7 years of schooling and a PhD. Come back when you hit that mark. And he's like, guys, I love you. I love science and all of this stuff, but absolutely not. And today, those very scientists are employed at his company called Coral Gardeners. They have something like 75 employees, and they are responsible for replanting some of the most amazing coral reef on earth have been replanted and thriving, all because of gumption and creativity and innovation. So what can you do? You're an accountant somewhere, right? What can you do that Tito Juan has done in your accounting practice? It's all about just start. So for that accountant, I tell him, just dive in. What was that idea that you guys had? I want to streamline my software to be able to do outreach. Cool. Did you do it? No. Why didn't you do it? I'll do it tomorrow. Okay. Well, this guy is saving the earth. just because he took the initiative to just do it. Now you, Mr. Accountant or Mrs. Accountant, you're going to go and start this service that you're doing, that outreach, go to the three or four groups of people in the new client list or whatever it is, just by going for it and taking a chance, getting out there and just starting. So the book looks at amazing problems like that, what people are doing to solve it. And then I give some subtext of what anybody can borrow from them that they're doing to use in their own lives.
So willingness not just to embrace creativity, of course, that's foundational in what you're saying here, but trying to help people to find the courage, because that seems to be a great challenge for a lot of people. We live in a world that is social media driven. The idea of being compared to is very, very strong. Nobody wants to fall on their face, particularly in public. Nobody wants to be embarrassed by. And so a lot of the time that seems to block a lot of the creativity. What if I do this and I look like a dick? What if I do this and I make a huge mistake? What if I'm the laughing stock? And what I'm hearing from you is you have to be willing to be the laughing stock, because you might also be the superstar.
100%. We've taken out the risk and the mistake making of in our day-to-day approach of business. It's amazing. And we're wondering why we're not getting anywhere, why we're not successful. Well, we have stopped making mistakes and we have stopped taking chances. And we wonder, hey, why aren't those new people subscribing? Why aren't we more effective in this market? Why aren't we moving product over here? And why aren't we selling more software or whatever it is? Where are the subscribers? Well, they're not there because we're not willing to make enough mistakes in our approach, learn from them and tweak them. Listen, Tito Juan made a lot of mistakes with the reef. He used rope. You shouldn't use rope down there. He used a particular type of graft that he was doing. You shouldn't use that graft. That graft died. It looked good for a little while, but then died, and on and on and on. We have given up on that iteration because we look at the media and we look at social and we see some founder of a company who's 24 years old driving a Bugatti. And we say, hey, I want to be that guy too. And that guy tells you, I've never had a problem in my life. I am the most charmed human being ever. I am so charming. People throw money at me. And you and I know that's bullshit, but so many people get caught up in it that they become afraid to take risk and take chances on ideas that can change the world.
I agree. We're already at the end of part one of this delicious conversation here. I want to make sure that people can find out more you, about your new book, about your other books, about all the wonderful things that you're doing, all your wonderful resources. Please let people know.
Thank you. So it's Nirbashan, N-I-R-B-A-S-H-A-N. There's three of us on the planet Earth. There's one guy uploading video game clips. That's not me. There's another guy in Israel. I think he's like a manufacturer. That's not me. I'm the one with the books and the creativity and the innovation. Easy to find me, nirbashan.com. The books are on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, anywhere you buy books, The Solution Mindset.
Okay, and we'll make sure that those links are posted in the show notes. So if you didn't catch it, don't worry, they'll be there for you. And we'll also post all of Nir's social connections as well for you. We're going to be back in just one click. So stay curious, my friend. Stay curious about the solutions that are waiting for you on the other side of your own embarrassment. We're going to be back in one click. Welcome back to part two of our delicious conversation with author and returning champion, Nir Bashan. He is the author of a brilliant new book called The Solution Mindset, Mastering the Art of Problem Solving. And he has really been talking to us in part one of the show about how everything is really rooted in creativity, but how we have to really re-examine what creativity is and how we've been looking at creativity very much from a limited point of view. And that when things are tough, and while we're being told that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, that this is the time for creativity. It's not the time to look away from creativity, but it is the time to embrace creativity. So one of the things you were talking about actually towards the end, Nir, was that your idea for the book was, what are the 10 greatest problems? I think you said that, correct me if I'm wrong, but what are the 10 greatest problems the world faces today? and you use ChatGPT to help you find that. That might be a provocative question, which is, do you think that ChatGPT is helping, or when I say ChatGPT, AI is helping or is giving us a way to sort of separate ourselves from our creativity?
Great question. Here's what I think, okay? I think that Silicon Valley has the greatest self-congratulatory theme out of any business on earth. It used to be Hollywood, Dove. Hollywood used to put out a movie and everyone, oh my God, this actress, and oh, it's something you have to see, and the glamour of the Oscars. Wow. And now it's like, eh, who really cares about Hollywood? They're doing version 7 of Fast and Furious or whatever. That glamour, that mystique is all gone. Okay. And it seems that the baton was passed to none other than the technology sector. I remember when IoT was going to take over the world. Oh, Nir, your toaster is going to be on the internet. You don't understand. It's going to change how we toast forever. You remember that, Doug?
Yep, IoT, the internet of everything.
Yeah.
Right.
And then after that came the cloud. Oh, the cloud. Wow. Wow. This is literally something that is hard drive that is in the ether.
Except it's not. It's in the desert and it's owned by Amazon.
Yeah, right.
And those bosses are making money off you all the time. The cloud is not in the cloud.
Right, right. Oh, yeah. And now it's AI.
Yeah.
This is the most self-congratulatory industry since Hollywood. They're so good at keeping that PR machine going. Look how amazing we are. AI, right? Okay, is AI good? It's okay. Can AI make you more creative? Probably not. It's good for menial tasks like make me a list of 10 of the worst problems on earth, you know, which it did. And by the way, I got rid of 3 or 4 of them because it was dumb. It didn't really work. As all your listeners know, ChatGPT or any of the AI software, like some of it's pretty good, some of it's not. And what do they tell us? Don't worry. The next version will change everything. It's just going to get better and better. So I don't believe in that whole love affair that we have with technology. There was a study from MIT that came out about 2 months ago, and they put people in MRIs. I was telling a friend, I'm on this study. It takes, I don't know, 100 studies a week, and anything in technology or social issues or people issues, it sends me an email. And I get the study, and I don't just read the abstract. I read the whole damn thing. Scientists love putting people in MRIs now. It's kind of like a big deal. It's a serious study. Why? Because we can quantify and see on a monitor what it is that they're going through. And aha, that's proof. Okay, so they put these people in an MRI. Some of them, they ask them questions, American history, something like that. They put them in the MRI. They ask them questions. One cohort had ChatGPT, one did not. And the neural activity in those who had ChatGPT was the smallest they've ever seen in any test ever, meaning that only one tiny area of the brain was active. People were just telling the machine what to do, and it was giving them feedback, and they were giving average answers, which is what you get from ChatGPT or any of the AI software. The people who didn't have it saw normal and healthy brain response, the same that they would see in somebody who's studying, a student, or somebody of that level that is used to using different parts of their brain to solve different problems. And so what do I believe? I believe that ChatGPT is a tool like anything else. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe all of the stuff that they're peddling, because I think it's destructive, honestly, Dove, especially when it comes to social media.
So do you make a distinction between social media and AI?
100%. There's a lot of AI in social. Listen, I haven't seen a report in the last 10 years, a study, not one, that showed that social media has any redeeming quality at all. Not only for kids, zero redeeming value. And why am I the guy who's saying that? Why aren't others saying that too? Why aren't we getting it out there that people understand that Facebook, Twitter, X, TikTok, LinkedIn, all Insta, all of those brands have zero additive value into our day-to-day discourse, into our day-to-day lives. What they find is greed. They find a lot of comparison. They find a lot of depression. Depression in kids. Why? Because they're on Instagram too much. Dove, we've been sold a bunch of lies on AI and the social media and a lot of technology these days that it's supposed to make our lives better and it's supposed to make our lives easier. But every damn study that I look at shows the exact opposite.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. I wrote a special report. It's actually available on dovebaron.com. It's called Silicon Soul, and it's talking about AI and transhumanism, really. I was on stage talking about this in many different arenas. Listen, I'm excited by AI just like anybody else. And I understand that people are excited by AI and people are terrified of AI. That's hyperbole either way. Let's just go to the simple facts. And so I'm sitting on stage next to AI experts, the best in the world. And I said, so here's the thing. Put your hand up if you remember the world before the internet. Put your hand up. So I put my hand up. Good. Do you remember being excited about the internet? I certainly do. Do you remember why you were excited about it? I said, I was excited about it because it was going to become this big town hall. This place where everybody would have a voice, they'd be able to say things, they'd be able to see things you couldn't normally see. For me, it was like creativity exploding and intellectual creativity exploding. I thought, this is going to be wonderful. Then do you remember it came? Yes. And then there was something called Internet 2.0. So that had gone from ba-ding, 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 AOL building up the screen. And then you were going to get moving imagery. It was like, oh my God, this is going to be so great. I was so excited about it. And then it came. And now here we are, wherever we are, whatever it might be. And I say, can we see the damage? And we all go, yeah. How has it affected our kids? We've all got a list of things of how it's affected kids, how it's affected society. A lot of those things are very bad. Kids hurting themselves, comparative, insomnia, self-harm, etc. And I say, okay. And this is on stage. I'm going to sit on stage with the expert. I said, now, before I go any further, let me just say, I'm pro-AI, just like I was pro-social media. But let me just ask you a question. Today, if you get to go back in a time machine to the beginning of the internet and you get to put guardrails in place, knowing what you know about the damage to your children, what guardrails would you put in place? And I'm asking these experts on AI, what guardrails would you put in place? And I'm asking the audience, what guardrails do you put in place? And they say, oh, we'd do this and this and this. Ah, now it's because you know the problems, right? And they go, yeah. I said, but you may have been excited about the internet before it happened. Were you? Yes. I'm excited about AI, and I know the problems will be a millionfold, and I'm not exaggerating. That's not like, oh, a hyperbolic number. No, it's at least a millionfold to what social. So why the hell are we not considering the guardrails now? And the answer is very simply, you can ask Elon Musk, you can ask everybody else who's big in the AI world. The very reason there's no guardrails, because there was a meeting in Paris just a few years ago, and the people who wouldn't sign off on it were very simply America, England, and China. And the reason was they wouldn't sign off on the guardrails because they'll lose the competition. It's about money. The problems are going to be way bigger. You can see that, but you're still not stopping it. So really, is it AI that's the problem or is it our greed that's the problem? That's the challenge. And so we deify these things. We make them so wonderful, so magnificent because they're going to make coin. But they're not going to make coin for everybody. It's only for the people at the top. And the rest of the people, you're going to get washed away. You're going to get washed away like yesterday's lunch down the drain and just struggling to make sense. But if you can tap into your creativity, because at that same conference I said, here's what you need to know. The future of work is human. And they go, what do you mean? I know you've been told the future of work is AI. It is. That's true. But the future of work for those who matter will be human. The more humanness you can bring to the experience, i.e. your creativity, i.e. your personal service, things that are very human, that's what's going to make it work.
100%. There's going to be something after AI too, Doug. Like the AI, not the stop of all technological advancements. They're going to come out with something that's going to be way better. And AI is going to seem like the cloud or IoT in a couple of years. When they listen back to the show, they're going to be like, that Dove guy in there, man, are they smart. They predicted that there's going to be another something. Yeah, there'll be another something. What won't change is the human ability to engage, to interact. I was on a stage last week in front of 2,200 people in Houston, Texas. And people were worried, hey, what do we do with all this technology and stuff? I said, double down on the human factor. That's what you do. What can you do that the machine can't? Well, the machine's way better than me. Wrong. The machine is not way better than you. You're better than any machine ever. Why? Because you have empathy. You have the ability to talk to somebody. You could sit with somebody in person, and within the first 5 seconds, you know, they're concerned about this. They're concerned about that. They don't want to do this. They really want to do that. You could tell. you can have a conversation, you double down on all of the old school things, the human element, the value of solving problems with a creative and innovative spirit. That is the stuff that will get you through. If you're wondering, how will I survive with this AI and these insane super machines that are, you know, robots and all of this stuff? The answer is simple. The answer is creativity, innovation, coming up with different ideas, solving different problems. The best that AI can do right now is search the internet and find something in the past. That's the best it can do. It fed what to solve problems with, and all of the stuff that it's fed exists in the past, Dove. It's not in the future, not even in the gosh dang present.
No.
It needs the data from 5, 10, 20 minutes ago, an hour, 10 years ago, in order to properly solve any kind of problem. And the data that the engineers test it with and prep it with and prime it with is incredibly false, incredibly flawed. There's some stuff in there that's like really good and some stuff in there that's really not good. It doesn't replace a human classical liberal interpretation of what is going on in front of them. Read more. The classics are incredible. I talk about it in the book. You want to compete with AI? Read Socrates. Read Cicero. That will help you compete very, very well with AI. Why? Because it will teach you how to think like a human. And thinking like a human and solving problems in a way that only you can is an incredible, incredible advantage.
So if human beings are, as you put it, wired to solve problems, why do so many intelligent leaders, maybe they feel it, but behave like they're helpless? Do you think it's a learned helplessness or is it something else?
I think it's a learned institutional helpless. I think they love companies that do well. I'll give you an example. There was a bike company that manufactured bicycles, very high-end bicycles, and they would ship them out of Europe into the US, Canada, whoever ordered really, really nice bikes. Really nice bikes. I mean, like high-end, carbon fiber, the frame weighed like, you know, a feather, right? And they would ship them, and they would get to a customer, and they would break. Why would they break? Because the customer would open the box, and no matter how much cushion and how many times they wrapped the frame and the fork and the brakes and the whatever, they would show up shattered because somebody would take the box and toss it. Okay, so they got together and they said, here's the leadership team. Here's the problem. We have shipping issues because people are unboxing it and there's broken parts. And a bunch of traditional ideas came out. Well, let's use DHL instead of FedEx. They're better. Let's use UPS instead of these guys. And on and on and on. All the traditional ideas were there. The engineer said, let's wrap the box better. The parts manufacturer said, well, we could make something a little thicker so it's more susceptible to drops when people ship it, on and on and on. And then somebody in the room said, guys, I just got an 86-inch screen delivered to me. There's no way that our shipping or whatever is worse than what the TV people are using. A big-ass 86 that's in my living room showing football, okay? It came in one piece. And then somebody else said, are they using a better styrofoam? Bring the styrofoam in. And then another person said, well, they're using the new corrugated box, blah, 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 and it's probably what they're doing. Bring the box in. And on and on. And then somebody said, wait a second, that's a really good idea. Why don't we put a photograph on our boxes of a TV? And we put the word fragile, okay? It kind of looks like a TV. The box kind of ships the same way. What would happen? And overnight, Dub, overnight, fewer breakages, no change in packaging, no change in engineering, no change in the approach other than the creative idea to put an image of a TV. It would ship and people would get their bike in one piece. Why? Because somebody thought, oh yeah, there's a TV in it. I'll be a little bit more gentle. A total cost of 6 cents for the print on every box that they had to pay extra and saved millions of dollars down the line. So it is about coming up with the ideas, those creative and wonderful ideas, not being afraid to fail, being okay with iteration after iteration to get there that could literally change the earth. And our leaders are so stuck in one modality of thinking of analytics only. Let's listen to an engineer. Let's get a bigger box. Let's get more padding. Let's get that styrofoam made in whatever's factory because it's just a little bit better. And oh, look, the vendor came in and did a report. And you sit in hours and hours hours of meeting on the foam density of one shipping material versus another when all you had to do is change the way you're looking at the problem. We have so engrossed ourselves in quote unquote traditional channels, which is analytics only, look at the numbers to death, give me the foam density of that particular packing material, when we should have just said, hey, let's come up with some really good ideas, guys. Let's have a silly idea meeting on how we're going to ship this better without changing any of the engineering, without changing any of the boxes. Boom. And then you go and you create one of the best ideas ever.
That's such a great example. Thank you for that. Such a great example of a silly idea, because that's the meeting. And in that meeting, somebody says, let's print a picture of a telly, of a TV set on our bike boxes. And people are like, that's a stupid ass idea. Fantastic. Right. Let's do it. As Rory Sullivan says, the great killer of creativity is analytics. It actually kills creativity. It gets in the way, because the thing that analytically makes sense is often the thing that doesn't creatively make any sense, and certainly doesn't make any sense to the consumer on the other side. Sometimes it's the opposite of what it looks like intellectually or analytically. I interviewed Howard Behar, who was the CEO for Starbucks, and we talked about what a stupid idea to open a coffee shop that would sell coffee back then for $5. We used to nickname it, it wasn't called Starbucks, we used to call it $5. I'm going for a $5. Like, who the hell's going to pay that? I can get a cup of coffee for 75 cents or a dollar. And you want me to pay $5 for what tastes like burnt coffee? I don't think so. But as Howard Behar says, we weren't in the coffee business. We were in the people business. It was a place for people to come together. How do you do that? Well, they followed a very simple policy that was the English pub, the third place. So you had home, you had work, and the third place in England was the pub. What's the American pub? It's Starbucks. It's where you go. You're never going to convince me as a logical person that working people who are struggling to pay rent are going to pay $5 for a coffee. No, that's not going to happen. Maybe the elite will. No. Everyday working people, happily every morning, $5 a day, standing up for their latte, can't start the day without it. What? Are you crazy? How do we get that across, Nia? How do we get that across? I'm really challenging you. How do we get that across to people that the stupid idea is often the greatest idea, but you have to have the courage to try it out.
Yeah, it just takes the will to make some mistakes. We have grown into a mistake-adverse society. And some of the stuff, when I consult with different companies, I've consulted with some wonderful, wonderful brands, is that I force them to make a mistake on purpose because they're so used to not making mistakes. So I tell the leadership team, okay, we're going to have this meeting and nobody's going to know it other than you. You're the C-suite, okay? Marketing, the CMO. You're going to go to that next meeting when you have it. Oh, in 2 hours. Okay, cool. What you're going to do is you're going to say something really dumb, okay? Something really stupid. What are you guys working on now? We're working on this product for the front line to help in this retail thing. I said, okay, what would be something really dumb? Well, like pink. We could color the cups pink. Nobody would buy it. Pink's not our brand color. I'm like, that's what you're going to say in the meeting. Cool. Next. You're the CFO. What's going on with you? Oh, you know, we have some bonding issues with this and that. Cool. When do you have the meeting with the banker? We have it next Tuesday. What would be something like so dumb to say in that meeting? You're going to plant something dumb to say in the meeting, because what's going to happen is people around you are either going to correct you, react to it in some way, or change it in some way, or say, hey, I don't know what's going on. It's going to cause all this controversy. And in that controversy, we'll get a creative idea, because you will show them that you're not afraid to fail, or you're not afraid to make a mistake. You're going to energize your team. Somebody's going to come up with some idea and let's see what happens. And they go and do it. Then they come back to me. They go, Nir, what a cool idea. I said the pink thing. And then somebody else said, why would we do pink? It's not our brand color. And then I literally said, because I like pink. And then it was silence for like 2 minutes. And then somebody said, you know what we could do? There's a shade that works and it's kind of our brand color. And all of a sudden we came up with this new design in a second that would help a particular brand team or whatever. The bankers on the CFO side said, what do you mean the rating's not A+? You were good with A, and on and on and on. And then one of them said, well, if we do that, then we could position it this way. And all of a sudden we came up with ideas. Dove, it's about sometimes injecting purposefully mistakes into your process for people who are so risk adverse to help them understand that, yes, sometimes mistakes lead to some of the most amazing creative discoveries.
And I think that's a really powerful and valuable idea. Now I'm going to push back a bit. And the pushback is this, that the problem is that people lack a lot of balls. And what I mean by that is, you go in and say something stupid, and people tug the forelock and go, yes, master. They don't argue. They're so afraid of confrontation. This is one of the greatest challenges I have in the organizations I work with. As I say, you've got conflict avoidance, and you're modeling it at the top. And so nobody fights back. Nobody says anything. So you can say a dumb idea, and everybody goes, oh, okay, boss. And so they just do it because they go, just shut up. I don't need any stress. And you'll never get their best ideas because that will cause conflict. So what you get is this milieu of ordinary. Everything's on the ordinaire. Nothing is ever going to be special because nobody wants to create ripples in the water. And what you're talking about is creating ripples in the water. Creativity is disruptive. And people go, you know, we're a disruptive environment. No, you're not. You're full of shit. You say that, but you're actually not. Disruptive means that they're going to disagree with you. So I think you've got to get them over that hump first.
Yeah. So here's what happens. There are many clients that I have that are in that mindset where the boss says yes, everyone says yes, sir, yes, ma'am, and they go and execute. Well, what happens is if you tell the marketing team that that particular frontline team needs a pink cup, they'll go and design it, and you'll look at it as it comes back, and you'll say, well, you know, I wasn't really thinking pink. I was thinking blue. And they'll go and they'll redesign it again and they'll show it to you and it's like a pinkish blue or whatever. And then you have the opportunity to say, guys, you know what? I don't know if it's pink or blue. What do you think? And then they go, oh, wow. Like, here's an opportunity for me to chime in. I think we should go with the blue with this logo and blah, blah, blah. It kind of energizes people. You need to show some vulnerability at work, Dove, in order to get to the next step. And some of my greatest work with leadership is telling them it's okay to make a mistake. They're like, Nir, I got here because I made no mistake. I'm like, bullshit, you made a lot of mistakes. You just fixed them and capitalized them and done really well with how you've overcome them. And you're leading an entire team now without allowing them to do that exact thing that got you where you're going. The exact thing that got you where you are is the ability to make mistakes and learn from it. And you won't let your team do it because you expect them to come up with perfect things all the time. So yes, agree with you 100%. It's about that vulnerability, that opening yourself up to those different ideas. It really is about balancing the analytics and creativity, because right now we're 100% analytic in most businesses. Now, I'm not saying to throw out the analytics. I'm saying some of those numbers are incredibly useful, but we need to balance it with a sense of creativity, a sense of allowing people to make mistakes, a sense of editing complexity out of things. The whole other thing that I work with leadership teams on, they love complexity. Why? Because it looks like we're doing a lot of good work, Nir. Look, 622 pages on this contract. I work with legal all the time on this. I was like, guys, do you really need this many pages? Yes. Why? Well, we'll change the font and we'll knock off 30 pages, become from 12 point to 11 point. I'm like, get rid of the complexity and you will see innovation and creativity happen. There's so many tools at the disposal of leadership these days to ignite and energize creativity, not only in themselves, but in their organization. You don't have to get rid of your safety blanket, you know, your cuddly safety blanket, which is analytic. You just have to begin to balance it with creativity.
But I think you just said something that's really important that happened, and that is that people often stump out their own creativity with more. Like, if I do more, if I'm busier, if I add more complexity, because sometimes creativity is actually the simplest outcome. Sometimes it's the less, not the more. And I think that that's the other thing we've got around creativity. Not only is it only for dancers and singers and artists, but it's the ability to do more. For me, at least, it's to do less. I'm most creative if I can find a way to do less. And it's not lazy, because that's different. Do you agree with that? That doing more steals it?
Sometimes the most difficult things are deducing things into more simple terms. And as leaders, we're always afraid of doing that because it doesn't look as impressive. And I ask you, who does that look impressive to? Exactly. Why are we trying to impress that particular person with complexity? Listen, the Doug Barron Show is a prime example of what I'm talking about, Doug. You have some of the best thinkers on earth on your show.
Thank you.
And you're able to take really complex ideas, sometimes 10 books on the same topic by some esteemed writer or thought leader, and you're able to deduce these thoughts into very, very simple takeaways. And that's why your podcast is so world-renowned. People love it because they listen to you and they know that they can grab 3, 4, 5 brilliant ideas from your guests in easily digestible, friendly, incredibly useful chunks. You have that ability to take the clutter and make it into information. Well, that ability exists in every human on earth. And it's a choice that we make. As leaders, do we choose complexity because it makes us look impressive or shows us, oh, look, you know, if the boss is churning in 600 pages and the employees need to churn in 600 pages, I would rather any day receive a beautiful paragraph or two than 30 pages on a topic when the paragraph or two are deduced into something incredibly meaningful. And that takes years of discipline. It takes a lot of work to deduce something very complex into something easy and tangible. And that's the work that we need to be doing. That's creative.
Fully. So as a final question, what's the single simplest change someone can make right now, like within the next 10 minutes, that'll help them to become more creative at work?
I think the one thing that your listeners can do right this second, they're like, Nir, I'm in. I love it. What can I do tonight? I'm on my way to work. What can I do today? Start to choose better words. I've researched the English language nonstop, and there's a 6-to-1 ratio of negative to positive words. So for every great, wonderful, there's bad, horrible, terrible, the worst, sucks, blah, 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 on and on. I've researched something like 56 languages all over Earth. There's between a 4-to-1 ratio and a 12-to-1 ratio of negative to positive words. Isn't that crazy?
That is. Wow.
So what I would love your listeners to do, they're sending an email as they're listening to this podcast. They're texting their assistant. They're texting their boss, whatever. And we all do it. We're guilty of it. But if we choose our language carefully, the results can be incredible. Instead of sending that text, send that invoice out by 6, Dove. Say, hi, Nir. Hope you're doing great. I know that your son's playing football. How's the football team going? When you get a chance, it'd be great. Send me that invoice. I want to look at it. And we want to get you guys paid quickly. You know that we're on net 45, but we can do a net 30. It's going to be great. Thanks, Dove. The difference in the two is dramatic. One is positive, one is negative. When we choose positivity, creativity generates and follows. When we choose negativity, nothing good happens. Nothing. So we're choosing positivity. We see something good happen. I get the email. I'm like, yes, Dove, thank you. Here's the invoice. By the way, you're doing great in football. There's this going on and that going on. And you should meet the coach. And you go, Coach Randy? Randy Smith from Vancouver? Randy and I went to school together in Australia. I love that guy. Is he still at X company? Yes, he's still at X company. I'd love to reach out to him. Can you make an intro? Of course. Hi, Randy. It's me, blah, blah, blah. You remember Dove? And then all of a sudden you guys explode on your own thread and you do work together. When we choose positivity, Dove, what ends up happening, it's a force multiplier. We get a chain of reaction of events that we can never foresee in an analytical mindset start happening for us simply because we made the choice to be positive. And those are the types of things that I want to reinforce in your listeners. Choose better language. Start with better words.
Beautiful. What a great and powerful point to end part two of the show. Nir, as always, it's a pleasure and honor to have you here, my friend. Please make sure that people know how to find out more about you, your books, and all of your resources.
NirBashan.com. The new book is called The Solution Mindset. It's a Wiley & Sons release. The last book was a 100 best nonfiction book of all time. And I'm hoping that this book makes the list as well. I cannot wait to hear your thoughts. I'm very easy to find. Nir, NirBashan.com. Would love to hear from your listeners and can't wait to hear your thoughts.
Thank you so much. I hope you'll stay with us to the end. And for you, dear listener, remember, those who control the meaning for the tribe also control the movement of the tribe. Leaders who are committed to positively shaping the political and business landscape know they must tap into what drives the human behavior. I'm Dove Barron. I work with elite leaders across industries who are committed to soulfully guiding the destiny of the world, showing businesses, teams, and leaders how to harness their emotional source code to move their tribe. because unified, actualized meaning is the single monolithic difference between mediocrity and greatness for all individuals and companies. Remember, we need your help in staying relevant, so please go to wherever it is you tune into the show from and do us a favor, rate, review, and subscribe to the show. And of course, a big thank you to you, if you are a regular listener, for sharing the show with everybody you know. Till next time, stay curious, my friends. Stay curious about how you can re-tap into your creativity that has got nothing to do with painting or drawing or dancing or any of the other things you think of traditionally as creativity. But creativity is your access to solving problems. Make sure you find out more about how to do that with the Solution Mindset from Nir Brasham. I'm Dov Barron. I'm here to assist you tapping into your deepest meaning to reach that next level of clarity, focus, purpose, and profit in your business, in your life, and your leadership impact. And I am out.